and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk about being an advocate for yourself, for a child, for a loved one, and how to go about doing it, how to become an active part of your healthcare team. Coming up in this hour, we're going to speak with Nahama and her daughter Ashira and learn their story. It's a very intense story, fortunately with a happy ending. In the first few months of Ashira's life, Nahama went through one of the most frightening episodes of her own life. Stick with us now. After these messages, we'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clenton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. Our guest today is Nahama. She and her daughter went through a pretty harrowing experience when her daughter was less than 3 months old. And so we're going to talk with Nahama about what she went through and what she learned in being an advocate for her daughter. So your daughter is how old now?
She will be 7 in April.
Yeah, she's adorable.
Thank you.
Yeah, and a bouncy little 7-year-old.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. But, I mean, it's interesting because she had a bit of a fever yesterday, and everything comes rushing back.
Yes.
You know, it was 7 years ago, but everything comes rushing back. She's got a fever, and can I catch it? Is it something serious, you know? I mean, whatever happened, you know, when she was a baby, it's just like it just never goes away, the seriousness of what had happened then. And I wonder, you know, like, is this just typical routine childhood illness,
right,
you know, or something more serious.
Or is it something more serious?
It was, you know, I sat there just watching her thinking, you know, what am I going to be going through now, you know, and she just had a fever and it was nothing serious. Yes, dear.
We met in their apartment, so you'll hear child noises in the background, and there's a bird or two that lives in the kitchen that once in a while will speak up. A very pleasant, delightful apartment filled with child toys on the floor and Nahama's books on the wall. And you can very easily see just from looking around, she has an MBA. She's worked for a long time in the corporate world. Then she became a rabbi, and after being in a pulpit for a short period of time, decided that she would go into Jewish education. So she works with an organization dedicated to Jewish education. You will also hear her speak of her Jewish roots. Once in a while, she mentions what she did on Shabbat, which is the Sabbath day. So tell me what happened. You're a single parent.
Right. Well, I had been thinking a while about adoption, you know, as a single woman, and decided that I would, you know, go forward with it. And quite a process, you know, going through the adoption process, et cetera, but had decided that I would adopt from Vietnam because I could get a baby at, you know, going through Vietnam. And went over there, and it was quite unusual, you know, the circumstances and going over to pick up Ashira, because I had just been, I was sort of towards the end of the process, you know. They had sent me a picture and sent me some information about the baby that was, you know, to be assigned to me. And I was told that this was beginning of June, that I probably would not be able to pick her up until September or October. In my mind, I'm thinking it's going to be the high holidays. And, you know, what if I have to wind up spending Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, you know, in Vietnam? What would I do?
Right.
I said, if that's where God wants me to be at that time, that's where I'd wind up being.
Sure.
But it was supposed to be about 6 months until I'd be able to, you know, to pick her up. And so I was then going through the process. I accepted the child. I had to make my final payment, et cetera. And all of a sudden, you know, several weeks later, I get a phone call saying, you've got 2 weeks. We need you in Vietnam now.
Oh, my.
And it was, you know, it was going to be like 3 months earlier than anticipated. She would, Ashira was not yet 3 months old when I went to Vietnam to pick her up. And usually they don't release children earlier than 6 months because they want to check their health and make sure that they're okay.
Right.
When I got into the country, they tell you it's going to take at least 3 weeks to go through the paperwork. So they want you to, you know, not make your return flight, you know, 3 weeks beyond when you arrive. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and it turned out we were done in 10 days.
Okay.
And so I wasn't feeling very well. You know, in Vietnam, I had gotten conjunctivitis, and I was a little bit ill. So I've decided not to take the full amount of the 3 weeks. I would have loved to see the country, but I needed to get home also. They check out the children before you leave the country, make sure that they're healthy. They're checked by a doctor, et cetera. Everything mm-hmm. checked out fine. Mm-hmm. Get back on the plane, you know, to bring Ashira home, and she wouldn't sleep the entire time. I mean, it's like 24 hours from start to finish with all the changes right. and everything, and she wouldn't sleep, and she wouldn't drink. She oh my wouldn't goodness. Drink anything at all. So when we landed, it was Friday, and landed in California, in Los Angeles. I have a brother who lives there, and decided to stay for Shabbat in, you know, with my brother. And I asked him when he picked us up, please, you know, take me to a clinic. I want to have Ashira checked out. She hasn't been drinking anything at all. Right. And so they did.
And 24 hours for a tiny baby, that's easy to get dehydration in that period right. of time.
So we took her to a clinic. They did a chest X-ray, see if she, you know, if she was sick, had pneumonia, whatever it is.
Right.
There was nothing showed up on the X-ray. Mm-hmm. So at my brother's house, she drank a little bit. She slept, wasn't too bad. Then we got home on a Monday. It was at the very end of July in 2001. Got home on a Monday, and she basically, you know, drank very little, you know, throughout the course of the day. And the following day, got a phone call from a sister of mine out in California who is a pediatrician, and said that that dehydration in children, in babies, is really very serious. I should, and this was late at night, this was Tuesday late at night, take her to the emergency room and just have her checked out. So my upstairs neighbor at the time happened to also be a pediatrician. I asked him to come down and mm-hmm. just take a look. And he didn't have his, you know, equipment with him. He just said, there's nothing you could really, nothing I could really tell by looking at her now. I would say that for a child this age, definitely take her to the hospital.
Okay.
So we went to, it was, I guess, July 31st. We went to Children's Hospital. And I figured she's just dehydrated. I took the diaper bag with me. I took, you know, a bottle with me. Not very much else. And we got there probably around 11 o'clock. Was probably seen about 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I'm exhausted. You know, we had just been through so much. And trying to stay awake while I've got her there in the, you know, in the hospital. And she's cranky. And walking around for a few hours until they could finally see us. So here it is, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And they tell me that she's got pneumonia.
So after 2 days of air travel from Vietnam to Boston with a 2.5-month-old baby, she's in the hospital in the middle of the night hoping to be seen. And of course, with a baby that's suspected of having only dehydration, she's at the bottom of the triage list. You know, they divide the people in the emergency room into three parts. One, the really urgent cases, people who aren't breathing or have a broken limb that's sticking out or some bleeding all over the floor. Those get seen immediately. Then people who can wait a little bit, and then the people who, if they wait for a couple of hours, are going to be okay. And she was put into that third category and waited about 3 hours before they began doing tests. And the tests revealed that this baby not only had dehydration, but she also had pneumonia.
And I'm panicking at this point. I call my sister in, you know, my sister who's the pediatrician in California, you know, wake her up, please talk to the doctors and see what they're saying. And so she said, yeah, you know, she's got pneumonia, you have to bring her, you know, they're going to admit her. So they admitted her, and they kept her under observation for a while. And we were there probably a couple of days, and one of the nurses who came on shift, you know, takes a look at her, you know, the oxygen absorption, the sat rate, and goes, she's got to be intubated. Why isn't she intubated? And, you know, I've been sitting there with her. Basically, I had decided that I was not going to go home. I was going to be there with her, mm-hmm. you know, in the hospital room. So they intubate her, and I'm watching. It was very interesting because she was having difficulty breathing, but now they put this oxygen mask on her, and she's thrashing around, and I'm getting hysterical. And it's like, what are you doing to her? She can't breathe. And the doctor is, it's particularly because she can't breathe that we're putting the oxygen mask on her. And they look at me and they say, you could leave the room now. And I said, well, I'm not leaving the room now. And, you know, I realized if I want to stay in the room, I've got to control myself. So I'm mm-hmm. watching, and they finally, you know, they had the oxygen mask on her, and then they, you know, brought in the equipment to intubate her. And it basically, she was intubated then 4 weeks. She
so
was
here's in. A three-month-old baby right. with a tube, and you're terrified and jet-lagged and all of the above.
Right. Oh,
must have been horrible.
But I knew at that point, I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, before I went, you never know when you're adopting a child, and especially, you know, overseas, the health of the child.
Sure.
So I was concerned, you know, what kind of medical exam would she have? What would they determine? And how would I know? And how would I know she'd be healthy? And, you know, and I had gone through, you know, a lot of emails with the adoption agency in Vietnam, discussing with them, you know, who are the doctors and how do they check the child out? And they said, well, if you don't trust us, you don't have to adopt a baby from us. And it had gotten kind of contentious because I was asking so many questions beforehand.
Right.
And now all of a sudden, I've got a baby back in the United States, my baby, who's been my child only for a couple of weeks at this point in time, mm-hmm. you know, and this was my child.
Right.
And, you know, the feeling was not like, oh, I got a defective one, so let's exchange it and get another one.
Right.
You know, this is my child.
Yeah,
2 weeks or not 2 weeks.
Don't come with warranties.
So I basically had decided that I was going to be there with her.
Yeah.
And they're not accustomed to having, you know, or at that time, I don't know what they do now, but at that time, I wasn't going to leave the room. They did have, I know at that time, you know, a room around, you know, in the emergency floor around the back, a parents' room, sort of, you know, like several beds in a large room, you know, one for men and one for women, that you could, and a shower somewhere in the back,
uh-huh.
that you could sleep there in the hospital so that you could be close. But I didn't even want to be separated. And basically, what I told them is, anytime you have any procedure to do, I want to be there at her bedside.
Right.
So that even in the middle of the night, you wake me up and I will be there. So it turns out that she was diagnosed with pneumocystis carini pneumonia. And that particular pneumonia is very prevalent among people with HIV/AIDS. That is a top killer of people with HIV. It's an opportunistic disease if you have no immune system.
Hmm.
So basically that they looked and they said, she has no immune system. Does she have HIV? That is one of the tests that they did in Vietnam, and it was negative there.
Right.
But they redid the test, and again, it came out negative. So if she has no immune system, they determined that she had SCID, severe combined immune deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, she has no immune system, and she would ultimately, when they were able to cure the PCP, the pneumocystis carini pneumonia, that they would have to give her bone marrow transplant.
Let's recap for a minute because this case is pretty complex. So here's a 2.5-month-old baby, just come in from Vietnam. She looked perfectly healthy in Vietnam. She was thin, but she was healthy. She'd been checked out by a doctor. She does not have AIDS. That's now been confirmed in the United States. But she has not only come down with pneumonia, but with a series of other infections, to the point where the doctors are saying it looks like her immune system is not functioning at all. She must have severe combined immune deficiency, or SCID, SCID, and that if that persists, if that is indeed what's going on, they may need to do a bone marrow transplant to rebuild her immune system, because her immune system's not doing anything. Let's take a little break here, and we'll be right back with more about Ashira's story. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back now with more about Nahama and Ashira. And the first order of business now for this tiny baby is to get her through the pneumonia. Her blood saturation rate, the amount of oxygen in her blood, is dangerously low, and they're having a very hard time getting more into her, even though they're pumping it in as fast as they can. Dr. Jerome Groopman, in his book, How Doctors Think, tells the story from his more medical perspective. And what he says about this point in the story is that she realized then what all doctors and nurses should know, that every clinical event has a core of uncertainty. No outcome is ever completely predictable. She prayed for the courage to engage that uncertainty. She would learn everything possible about Ashira's case and respectfully question each and every assumption about the diagnosis and the treatment. It wasn't because she didn't appreciate the skill and devotion of the doctors or the hospital. This was an extraordinary ICU team in an extraordinary institution. It was because God did not make people omniscient. In other words, God didn't make anybody who knows everything. We are all doing our best, and we are all imperfect. But at least Nahama could add her own research skills, her own questions, into the team's thinking.
And so immediately I go online, and I start looking up everything that I can find out about SCID, and to see what it is, how do you get it, what do you do about it, etc. And there's an organization that has a listserv for people, parents with children with SCID. So I join that immediately, and I write, this is, you know, my daughter, and this is the circumstances, and I get I didn't say my daughter at first, I just joined, and I get back a welcome note saying, oh, you must have a son. And I email back, no, I don't have a son, I have a daughter, and it is extremely rare because it's mostly boys who have SCID.
Huh.
So right there, all right, that's a red flag. Mm-hmm. My daughter has SCID. So I do a lot of research, and I find out all the different kinds, you know, that there are a variety of different kinds of SCID. And I asked, can you test for which particular kind it is? Yes, we can test for it. So I said, please do, please test. So they tested for, you know, variety, the most common kinds. She doesn't have that. So they said it must be a rare kind. In the meantime, I'm still in touch with my sister in California, you know, who's mm-hmm. the pediatrician. And she's got some friends that she's talking to as well. They're taking all kinds of tests. They want to know what her, you know, blood cell count is and make sure, you know, where it stands. And my sister is saying to me, you know, that her count, her T count, is too high, really, to have an immune deficiency. It wouldn't be that high. You know, to get this kind of pneumonia, it would be much lower. Mm-hmm. So I said to the doctors, why is it so high? Well, it could be her mother's T cells. That happens, you know, that soon, you know, after birth, it could be the mother's T cells. Can you test for it? Yes, we can. Please test for it. So I have them test, you know, to see, and it's not her mother's T cells. It's hers. Well, they could be, you know, inactive T cells, you know, that they're not, you know, they're more of a passive kind. Can you test for that? Yes, we can. And they test, well, they're active T cells.
So you're getting guidance from this family pediatrician.
Yes.
And also from the family support group that you found online that's beginning to raise red flags for you that this diagnosis just isn't fitting. But I like what you're saying about, you're asking the doctor, can we test for this? Can we just validate
right.
your opinion? And if your opinion's right, then obviously we'll go forward with it. But just in the off chance that it's wrong, then we
right.
won't be headed down the wrong path at too high a speed.
Well, that and a lot of research on the web. A lot
yeah.
of research on the web, looking everything up and finding out. And one of the things that was wonderful about Children's Hospital also is that they realized I wasn't leaving her bedside.
Mm-hmm.
I was there. I was observing. And they valued what I saw. So when they were doing rounds in the morning, within the first week when they were doing rounds, they would ask me to join them.
Wonderful.
And when they went around asking the different specialists about, you know, what do you see and what's going on, etc., they would always say, and what does the mother see? And they always asked me to participate. And there was one time, I was praying in the morning, you know, early, hoping to be done by the time they showed up, and they showed up early. And I was still in the middle of praying, and I finished, and I went out. And they apologized to me. They said, I'm sorry, we started without you. And it blew me away that, you know, that they valued so much. That was the best thing about it, is that they truly did listen. Right. And I put together, you know, the information from all these places. And then probably, you know, in the first week, one of the doctors there said also, I remember reading an article about babies adopted from Vietnam who got this kind of pneumonia because of malnutrition.
Oh, for heaven's
sake. I asked her if she could get me a copy of the article. And she did. And I read the article, and I said to them, why can't this be the case with Ashira? Mm-hmm. And they said, it's not. She doesn't have the classic signs of malnutrition. And I'm thinking, she doesn't have the classic signs of SCID either. So
true.
Why did they decide one way and not the other way? And why aren't they at least testing, you know, for the other way? And they said, no. And I said, I'd really like to have a meeting with the various specialists so that we could sit down and we can really talk about it. Mm-hmm. So what they accommodated me, which was just absolutely so wonderful. And they had the chief of immunology and, you know, a couple other people sitting at this meeting. And when I asked, why can't it be malnutrition, I happened to be wearing this T-shirt that I had gotten like at this secondhand shop in Louisville, Kentucky one time when it was to benefit people with AIDS. Mm-hmm. So it had red ribbon on it, and it said in the front of it, miracles happen. And when I said to him, why can't this be my daughter's case, that it is malnutrition? And he says to me, you see the shirt you're wearing? If that were the case, that's what would have to happen.
A miracle.
Exactly. And they said, and they were not following that route of it being malnutrition.
So they felt that it was so rare, that the chance that it was malnutrition was so rare that it wasn't even worth doing a differential diagnosis for it.
Right. And because it wasn't the classic signs.
And yet the SCID's theory of theirs was also a rare thing. It was rare for a female child to have SCID's. It was rare for it to occur in her, and yet they were pursuing that path.
And they couldn't even identify which SCID it was, because she was testing negative for the more common kinds, and they just said, it's going to be a rare SCID. So everything that they were saying was becoming more and more rare, not only being female, but not being a typical kind. The T-cell count was too high for it. I mean, everything was saying to me, this can't be it. This can't be it. Yeah. But they just said, no. It just wasn't malnutrition, and they weren't pursuing it. And I, you know, whenever and through this PCP pneumonia, I mean, she had a lot of fluid on the lungs, and every couple of hours they had to, you know, drain the lungs. They had to suction the lungs, and I'd be standing there next to her, holding her hand and stroking her and singing to her. I mean, just constantly standing there next to the crib. And of course, I mean, they didn't have accommodations for me to be sleeping there either, so all they had was a recliner chair. And I slept in a recliner chair next to the crib the whole time, and they'd come and they'd wake me up at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, whatever it was, so that I could be there when they were, you know, suctioning off the water in the lungs. But I, you know, every week or so I'd say to them, I want you to do another test on the T-cell count. And they did. If I asked for another test, they did another test. And when I asked, you know, whatever, you know, my sister would be coaching me in the background about the variety of different kinds of tests. If my sister would tell me that there's a particular kind of test, something they could test for, I did that. Mm-hmm. Anything that I read online that talked about a variety of different types, different tests, different things, I would ask for it. And they were very accommodating. It was
good.
Wonderful how good accommodating they were. And, I mean, even to the point that I would watch my daughter, you know, really closely and notice that sometimes she did better, you know, lying on her stomach. She was more comfortable. But she was intubated, and the nurses didn't want to put her on her stomach because they were afraid that it was going to knock out the tubing. Mm-hmm. And I advocated for her, and they were forced to, they had to put her on her stomach. They had to rotate her because I said so, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. They wanted to give her more painkillers. They wanted to drug her more so that she couldn't move around a lot and that she wouldn't be able to knock out the tube. And I said, no, I wanted her on just the minimum, what she needed, not to be in pain, But I wanted her aware that I was there. I wanted her to hear my voice. I wanted her to be able to react to me. I didn't want her to lose this time in the hospital and mm-hmm. be so out of it and so drugged that I'd be starting, you know, from way beyond, right. you know, in getting her to react to me and to attach, because there are issues about adoption and attachment anyway.
Right.
And here it is that she spent 3 months in an orphanage and now she'd be spending time in the hospital mm-hmm. and I wouldn't be able to, you know, to attach. And I had to fight that also.
Right.
But I mean, I took it up to whatever level I had to, you know, and spoke to whoever I had to speak to, and they realized I was there. And I said, if she knocks it out, I'm there. I'm going to let you know. It's not going to be, and she's, you know, she was in, you know, the ICU anyway.
Right.
So it's not as, and she was in isolation because they thought that she had SCID, which mm. happened to be nice because in isolation, there's a bathroom in that little, you know, ICU unit in that mm-hmm. particular room. So I had a place I could go to the bathroom. I didn't have to walk out.
So they were afraid that she might catch germs from another patient.
Which she did anyway. Uh-huh. She did. I mean, she wound up on so many different kinds of drugs because whatever was going around, she caught. Unbelievable. Mm. The amount of things. It took her 4 weeks to beat, you know, the pneumonia because so many other things. She had rashes all over her body. They didn't know whether she was allergic to the antibiotics, and they changed a few different things because there were mm-hmm. so many things that they were giving her at the same time
right.
that, you know, it just took a really long time for her to beat the pneumonia in the first place. And, you know, I'd be watching, and I remember there was one point also in the first week that she just wasn't able to absorb enough oxygen from the air. And they said if the sat rate didn't go up to at least 65, and she had been like down at 35, that they didn't know if she was going to make it or not.
Mm.
And the only, you know, thing that they could do for her was this thing called ECMO, where they actually make an incision in the neck and they insert the tubes and they draw out the blood and it goes through a machine where it gets oxygenated,
uh-huh.
you know, extracorporeal oxygenation, membrane oxygenation is
okay.
ECMO, where, you know, it's like a heart bypass kind okay. of machine where they take the blood out and they have to oxygenate it because she wasn't getting enough oxygen.
Mm.
And we were sitting there that night. My parents happened to fly in from Florida and they spent a few days with me in the beginning when Ashira was in the hospital. And we were sitting there and they said that they, you know, and it's a desperate measure because there are so many risks with the ECMO. Once you take the blood out and, you know, that what can happen and all the risks of infection and stuff that can happen. So it's sort of like the last ditch effort if she wasn't going to get enough oxygen. And so there I was, they gave me the permission form to sign and said, you know, these are the risks and here it is. And they had to move her from the ICU, you know, place she was to the other side of the floor where the ECMO machine was plugged in. And when they took her off, you know, off the oxygen that she was on, and they put her on, you know, the pump where they, you know, they squeeze that little pump as they're wheeling you across the floor. The hand pump. All of a sudden, she started to react, and
uh-huh.
they noticed that she was getting more oxygen. So as they're passing me by, and standing there in the middle of the floor with the permission slip in my hand, they said, wait a minute, she's reacting favorably. We may not have to do this after all.
Great.
And just at the 11th hour, the last minute before I signed that, they said, let's wait and hold off, and we didn't have to do the ECMO.
Great.
And I mean, just amazing. And it's just like we prayed that night. We just prayed, you know, just like at least hit the 65.
Finally, the oxygen levels in Ashira's bloodstream begin to rise, and she's beating the pneumonia. But that's only the beginning. There's still something very seriously wrong with her immune system. And that's the next order of business. Stay with us now. We'll take a little break, and then we'll be back for the next chapter of Ashira's story.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
We're speaking with Nahama about the story of her daughter's very serious illness as a tiny baby. I'm going to read another small section from the book How Doctors Think by Dr. Jerome Groopman. He tells her story as well from his more medical perspective, but with a great deal of sensitivity. And it's a very fine account. You really should read it sometime. He says, every morning and every evening, Nahama told me she stood next to Ashira's bed and prayed. She read from a pocket-sized prayer book, well-worn from daily use. Years ago, she had inserted a prayer of her own. It spoke to what she personally sought from God. Dear Lord, having been created in your image, I am full of unrealized potential, the realization of which depends upon my acknowledgement of the potential, my recognition of all the gifts from you with which I am endowed, and my exploitation of the opportunities that lie open before me. Please, Lord, help me rise to meet the challenge. Let me use those gifts for the benefit of all people. Dear Lord, for all that I am and all that I can be, I thank you. And never before had she prayed with such fervor for help to rise to meet the challenge of her daughter's illness.
So little by little, she did start getting better. And as I had them doing all these various kinds of tests, and as time went on, and finally she was beating the pneumonia, they said, we've got a window now. We know that we're going to have to do a bone marrow transplant. And she will probably need, you know, the port in the chest in order to get all the medications, a Broviac, I think they call it. Mm-hmm. See, I still remember some of these things from all that time ago, you know, that they wanted to do the operation to insert the Broviac. And I'm thinking to myself, she doesn't need it. She's not going to get the bone marrow transplant. She doesn't have SCID. But I'm saying to myself, do I know more than the doctors do? Can I prove them wrong? I can't prove them wrong. I have to follow both paths at the same time.
Right. So even though your mother's heart is saying, please don't do this to my baby, you can't be crazy about it. You know, right. If this is in fact medically what the baby needs, then you don't want to stand in the way of it. But on the other hand, you want to be very sure that this very invasive treatment is truly necessary.
I mean, the Broviac was just in order to allow. And then they brought us after they did that, and she had, you know, they were able to extubate, which was after 4 weeks. She stayed on, you know, in the ICU for an extra week, you know, just to make sure that she could breathe on her own. Mm-hmm. And they put in the Broviac, and then they brought us down to the floor to do the bone marrow transplant. And we were waiting
So give us a little background on the bone marrow transplant. So if she had SCIDs, which is this immune deficiency, then the purpose of the bone marrow transplant is to try to build new immune power
system
within her own body.
Exactly.
But it's a pretty devastating treatment to go through.
Not only is it devastating, but they also said that they only do a transplant from a related donor. And here I am, thousands of miles away, and, you know, I mean, related donor, they don't even mean mother, you know, birth mother particularly, because birth mother can only be, at best, a half match. Right. They want a sibling.
We get half of our genetic material from our mother and half of it from our father. So the mother is, by definition, a half match, but only a sibling would have material from both this mother and this father.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did know the mother's address in Vietnam because it was on my daughter's birth certificate. But do I dare? You know, I mean, heart-wrenching to give up your child. How do I get in touch with her and say to her, I need your help, but I'm not going to let my daughter die.
Right.
So I emailed the adoption agency in Vietnam. And I said, please, you have to save my daughter's life. I can't let her die. So you have to get in touch with the birth mother, and you have to ask her if she's willing. I said, they usually don't do, you know, the mother. But I will not ask her if there was another child. I will not, because what I knew was this was a single mother.
Right.
In a country, you know, like Vietnam, which looks down upon, you know, giving birth out of wedlock. And I'm not going to ask her. I'm not going to embarrass her. I can't do that much. But at least I could ask her if she's willing.
Right.
And she was willing. And they had to drive 2.5 hours to go pick her up where she lives, bring her back to Hanoi to be tested. In the meantime, I said to, you know, the people at Children's Hospital, and what if we can't do it from the mother? What about a non-related donor? What's the chances of survival? They said, we don't know. I said, well, how do you find out? They said, we have to get statistics. I said, how do you get statistics? Well, the National Bone Marrow Donor, you know, they can do statistics. I said, well, ask them to get statistics.
Right.
They get statistics and find out that there is a better chance through a non-related donor than there is through the birth mother.
Oh, for heaven's
because
sake.
It is possible to get a better than a 50% match from a non-related donor.
Hmm.
I said, I want you to go now and check the base for non-related donors. They came back with 30 possibilities.
Oh my goodness!
In the non-related donor database.
That's
30
amazing.
Possibilities.
That's amazing.
Which they weren't even going to look at in the first place.
Right.
Because they hadn't done it before.
Huh.
So here we
so
are.
So part of your role was simply asking the right questions.
Right.
And
right.
So you don't necessarily have to have greater knowledge, but just greater curiosity sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're, you know, in the bone marrow ward. And in the meantime, my daughter has had this enormous rash. Ever since she's been there, for 5 weeks she's had this rash, and dermatology has only come like every couple of weeks or whatever to look at it and try one thing or another, and nothing's worked. So finally they come down again while we're in the, you know, the bone marrow ward, and they do some tests, and they come back, and they say, she's got scabies. Now, one of the things that is very prevalent among, you know, babies from Vietnam is this thing called scabies, which they're like these little, you know, microscopic little bugs that get under the skin and cause this rash. And usually it is like in the webs, like between your fingers, between your toes. This was like all over her body.
Mm.
And I had her looked at in Vietnam. She didn't have a rash in Vietnam. And it looked at before we left. And people who know scabies very well said, no, she's fine. She doesn't have scabies. But here it is. They diagnosed her at the hospital with scabies. Now, the rash is an allergic reaction to the little venom or whatever it is in these little bugs.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden now, they believe she's got an immune system, that it can't possibly be scabies. At, again, the 11th hour before they're deciding that they're going to do a bone marrow transplant.
So if she has no immune system, she would not have had an immune reaction to the venom of the little scabies bugs.
Right.
So the fact that she had this rash, this immune reaction, is a signal that her body does, in fact, have an immune system.
Yes.
Wonderful.
So they give me, you know, I have to buy all this medication and stuff that both of us have to get treated head to foot, hair and everything, all the way completely on your entire body to be able to get rid of the, you know, the scabies. And so finally, now that we know that she doesn't need the bone marrow transplant, they transfer us back to the regular ward, and now they got to wean her off all the medication that she's on before they could send her home.
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. It is September 10th, 2001. And it is about 10 o'clock at night, and they say, we've run all the tests on your daughter, and we truly believe that now she has a regular, you know, she has a normal immune system. But there are a couple other things we want to get together tonight. We're going to have a meeting this evening with the whole, you know, the immunology department. We'll let you know tomorrow morning for sure to confirm our findings.
Mm-hmm.
I send out an email to all of my community, everybody that's been supporting me through all this, to tell them a miracle, it's a miracle that my daughter is normal. So now it's 9/11, 2001, at 9 o'clock in the morning, when the immunologist comes to tell me that your daughter is normal, but turn on your TV.
Oh, Lord.
So at the same time that we find out that thousands are dying, my daughter lives.
Wow.
And to this day, it's still the juxtaposition of that, that she's given life when so many thousands died, is still very difficult and very moving.
Sure.
And also, this was a Tuesday, 9/11.
Right.
And my daughter was discharged from the hospital on Friday. And we got home just before Shabbat. And Monday, that following Monday, was Rosh Hashanah. And at the season when we determine who will live and who will die, it's all of that together, that all these thousands died just before Rosh Hashanah, and my daughter lives, and that determination was just so incredibly difficult and incredibly moving and just very, very hard for me.
Of course.
But to me, the greatest lesson, and I mean, and now the lesson always that sticks with me is, you know, being an advocate, you know, that you have to either yourself or have somebody with you in that hospital who can really be an advocate, who can listen to what they're saying, who can research what they're saying, who can find, you know, people to talk to, and people who will be able to, you know, confirm or, you know, look at other angles, you know, and give you other information. And, I mean, I greatly respect the doctors at Children's Hospital. They were wonderful, and they went with their, you know, their best guess and their best knowledge, but they listened to me. And every time I asked, like the last time when they tested to see if Ashira had a normal immune system, I remember talking to the immunologist saying I wanted her tested again. And, you know, I mean, although they had tested her like every other week, you know, and he just looked at me and says, well, I have to have, you know, a normal sample in order to do it, and I don't have anybody around. And he just rolled up his sleeve. He says, all right, I'll do it for you. And he just stuck himself, you know, to take his own blood to do that
to
me,
compare,
you know, to do the comparison.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were enormously respectful of me and what I was saying and what I was asking and what I was checking for and open-minded enough, you know, to be able to listen to that. And I mean, that is crucial. That's really key, that they just don't take you as a hysterical mom. And I know that from the first reaction when they were, you know, putting the oxygen mask on my daughter and I was screaming, oh, she can't breathe. What are you doing? And you know, and they wanted me to go out of the room. I remember when, you know, several times when they needed, you know, at one time she extubated, you know, spontaneously.
The tube fell out.
And, you know, they kept saying, the mother can leave the room now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, the mother's not leaving the room now, you know. And there were a couple other times that they needed to do a variety of different things. And being a teaching hospital, you know, it wasn't always the most experienced doctor who was doing the procedures.
Right.
And they didn't want me to make the interns nervous. Right. And they would say, the mother can leave the room now. And I would say, the mother is not leaving the room now. And after about 3 weeks or so of saying that, they finally realized they don't have to ask me to leave anymore because I'm just not going. I need to be there. And I told them, whatever my daughter goes through, I need to be there and I need to see it too.
Now tell me, what did you learn about the ways that you could be that made it easier for the doctors to accept your input? So you said, you know, when you were screaming, they were saying, okay, now you can leave the room. So obviously that wasn't working, and you modified your behavior a little bit. And as you said, you were assertive, but not nasty, not aggressive. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, you have to have faith in doctors, and you have to know that they are doing the best with their best knowledge. And so I wasn't challenging, like, you're all wrong, and I know you're wrong because I know something different and I know better, because I wasn't sure that I did.
Right.
I had a different track, and I think by being respectful and also by being there, you know, that I had observations to share, because it wasn't just hunches. It wasn't that, you know, I was home doing some research and then I'd come in and say, you know, I want you to try something else. I think they respected the fact that I was there and I could watch and I could see. And also, you know, in that presence, if people can be there, it is wonderful. But I mean, I took off time from work, and I allowed myself to be able to do that. And I know people can't always do that.
Right.
So it doesn't mean that you can't be an advocate because you can't be there. I don't know, because I can only really talk about this particular instance and I know how the doctors trusted me, but I trusted them too, and I think they knew that. And although I had a different opinion, I never discounted their opinion. I just offered it as an alternative.
So you became part of the team.
Exactly. And it was wonderful that they allowed that. I was part of the team. The fact that they apologized because I wasn't there when they started let me know how much they did value me as part of the team, which was really wonderful. And I
so
did my
even
homework.
Though you didn't bring medical expertise, you brought observations that were very important, and especially for a nonverbal patient. I mean, when you see she seems more comfortable on her stomach, things like that, that becomes very valuable. And the nurses can't be there long enough to make those observations. Neither can the doctors.
Right.
We'll be back in just a moment to learn more about what Nahama learned from her experience and how you can be a powerful advocate for your own self and your own family. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clinton Winford. And again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. We're back speaking with Nahama about how to be a powerful advocate, to be a voice for your nonverbal patient, or for that matter, for yourself.
And there are a couple of PSs. One was, once I got my daughter home and I brought her to her regular pediatrician, I didn't even have time to get a pediatrician because we had just gotten home from Vietnam and she didn't have a doctor. So then I brought her to the doctor and he recommended that we go to a dermatologist, you know, pediatric dermatologist for her. And we brought her and we brought her to the dermatologist and he said, she doesn't have scabies. He had done, you know, a research project, a report on scabies. He called, you know, babies with scabies or scabies and babies or something like that, rhyming, you know. And he looked at her and says, that's not scabies. And it's like, well, I'm so grateful that they misdiagnosed it as scabies so that they thought it was and they knew she had an immune system, you know, which was wonderful. But he said, that's not scabies. You know, and I even, you know, one of the people in Vietnam that I had continued to be in touch with when I, you know, emailed her and said that this is what they diagnosed, she said, I don't believe so. You know, from what you're telling me, from where the rash is, and from having looked at the baby before she left, you know, Vietnam, I do not believe that it was scabies either.
So what did it turn out to be, or do you know?
I don't know. I mean, she was on so much medication, and, you know, it could have been that she was allergic to the antibiotics.
Yes.
But she happens to be on antibiotics now, you know, for the fever that she had, you know. Not for the fever. She had a swollen lymph node last week, so and she doesn't have a rash from that. So we don't think that she's allergic to the antibiotics. But and then also, the other PS is about 6 months later, they decided to do a grand rounds, you know, where they analyze a particular case at Children's Hospital, and they picked a Shearer's case to do the study of. And their conclusion was that it was malnutrition, that it truly was malnutrition. And, I mean, after the fact, you can't test for what it was a lack of, because they never did any of the testing to see what it was that she didn't have in her body at the time.
You'll remember that malnutrition was brought up during the time that they were in the hospital. There had been a study of some children in Tehran in the 1960s and in Vietnam in the 1970s who had developed pneumocystis because their immune systems had essentially collapsed due to malnutrition. But the children in that study were so incredibly malnourished. They were just bags of skin and bones. And Ashira never was that malnourished. So they had discounted that theory. But she worked through it over a period of time. You know, if she became well, but not immediately, right? How long did it take before she was really back on an even keel?
It didn't take long at all. Once she beat the pneumonia and the other, you know, the other diseases that she got when she was in the hospital, she was fine. She was fine. And I mean, to this day, when other kids in school come down with strep throat, she's never had strep throat. Okay. She rarely gets sick at all. Unbelievable how healthy she is. Thank God how healthy she is.
Yes.
That once the immune system came back, it sort of came back with a vengeance, and it is so strong and really powerful right now.
Great. So she's a healthy, bright, normal 7-year-old?
Yes.
Yes. Thankfully, that's great.
Absolutely.
So, and you mentioned one of the ways that you bonded with her, especially in the hospital, was to not only stay in touch with her, but also to sing to her.
Yes.
So I wondered if you'd mind singing for us something that you sang with her.
Okay.
You have a wonderful voice.
Thank you. When I found out that I was assigned, you know, this particular child and looked at her picture, I wrote a song for her. Not something that I do frequently. Actually, this is the only song that I've ever written. I do love to sing, but I was just so moved by having a daughter that I wrote this one for her. And I just simply call it For Ashira. Picture books on a dusty shelf, years pass, remain unread. Bears with dolls for company sit lonely on the bed. Aladdin courting Cinderella waits patiently to play. Jacks and balls and pickup sticks don't see the light of day. Jumping rope and roller skating, not much fun alone. Closet full of games and toys, and I'm almost grown. But you, my child, have come to read, to hug that lonely bear. My life, my arms have waited for you. Now at last you're here. You're here. Here. You're here.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And a little stinger from the bird.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on making it through such a difficult pass, and I hope you and Ashira have a very happy and medically uneventful life from here forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Nahama for sharing her story with us. I think that it's a very telling one that helps me focus in on why it's so very important to question. It's not being disrespectful to question. It's the tone of your voice and the attitude in which you do it. But if you respectfully question the doctors, you can sometimes fill in the gaps in their analysis and help them to see put other options that they might have considered and discarded, or they might have just forgotten to consider at all. It's okay to add to the conversation. It's not okay, as she said before, to discard their opinions. You can't discard it. You can't discount them. But you can add something into the discussion and inquire why we shouldn't consider yet another possibility. Let me talk for a minute, too, about doing analysis on the internet, because there are pros and cons to doing analysis on the internet. You have to be very careful. You know how they used to say, don't believe everything you read in print? Well, it's even more important on the internet, because there's no editor, there's no publisher constraining what people are putting out there. Anybody can put anything on the internet. And so you have to be very careful. Where did this information come from? Who is saying it? Why are they saying it? And is this medically proven information, or is it just somebody's opinion? Look for that information on the webpage. In the program guide that goes with this show, I have given you some hints for how to do that and some examples, some pages where we look together at the page and see where we can find the information. Down there somewhere on the homepage for every site should be some information about who owns this site, why it's there, what their purpose is. They're not always straightforward about it, but they usually are reasonably straightforward. And so you can see whether it's written by a doctor, whether it's put out by a hospital, whether it's put out by a pharmaceutical company that's trying to sell you their particular drug, or whether it's put out by a patient relating their own experience, or perhaps even a disgruntled patient who's very angry with the doctor about the way things turned out. out. So you have to read everything with a grain of salt and make sure that you are taking it for what it's worth. And some of it's worth a very great deal, and some of it is worth the paper it's printed on, which is non-existent, so that's fine. So, yes, be careful. Do go out on the internet, and do be careful on the internet. And again, when you walk into the doctor's office with 6 inches of paper printed out from the internet, most doctors will groan or because, you know, they're not sure you've sifted it through. But if, as Nahama did, you say, I've been out there with a patient support group. They're telling me that it's very, very rare for a girl child to have SCID. Since it's that rare for a girl child to have SCID, why aren't we looking at a couple of other potentially rare alternatives? You know, maybe we should look harder at malnutrition. So that kind of respectful interchange does work. Disrespectful interchange almost never works with anybody, but particularly with your doctors, because you don't know more than the doctor, okay? So challenge, but carefully. Push back carefully, and be a powerful patient. Keep those questions coming, too. It's delightful to hear from you. Simon, your CD is on the way, and we'll hope to be awarding you a CD the next time. Coming up in the next few shows, you're going to meet another kind of advocate, someone who signed on to be a healthcare proxy for a friend and was, in fact, called upon to be a healthcare proxy for her friend. So you'll hear a friend's experience being a healthcare proxy for Lisa. You will also hear more about the planning for our very exciting trip to South Africa that's coming up within the next several weeks. It's only, oh my goodness, it's only about 4 weeks before I go to South Africa. So it's getting very exciting here, and I hope that you will join us for the fun. We're going to do some recording in South Africa as well, and so I hope that you'll stay with us and enjoy the spring. And spring in South Africa is actually fall, so you'll get a few seasons in a quick succession here along with me. So let's stay together, and I wish you all the best. Be well, and be a powerful patient. See you next time.